Congressman Charlie Crist makes his case for governor. Again. Hello and welcome to Sundial. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Charlie Crist has a long history in Florida politics. Can he emerge from a challenging Democratic primary and face Governor Ron DeSantis next November? Speaking of DeSantis, Florida's governor announced yesterday that the state will be sending law enforcement officers to help states at the U.S.-Mexico border. Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett explains the latest news and has an update on Peru's presidential elections. Finally, West Broward High School students included a Black Lives Matter spread in their yearbook, but the school administration took issue. All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part with support from the Miami Cancer Institute. Welcome to WLRN Sundial. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez today. We're going to have a slight change of programming from what you heard a few moments ago, so thank you for sticking with us and joining us. Charlie Crist has become a household name in Florida politics. He served in the Florida Senate as Education Commissioner and State Attorney General before becoming governor in 2007. Crist was a Republican governor for 4 years, but then lost a statewide Senate race as an independent candidate and another run for governor as a Democrat. Now he's a congressman representing St. Petersburg, and recently he announced his candidacy for governor again as a Democrat. What questions do you have for the candidate? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or email us sundial@wlrnnews.org. Congressman Crist, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, Danny, it's great to be with you. How are things in South Florida?
They're doing great. Couldn't be better. So, Congressman, tell us, why are you running for governor again when you currently hold a very important congressional seat for Democrats in the state of Florida?
Because Florida is a very important state, and I love Florida, and I think Florida deserves better than the leadership that we're getting now out of the current governor. And I think it's time for a change. I really do. And that's why I'm running. I love Florida.
And your initial stint as governor as a Republican, and now you're running as a Democrat. Do you think that you can win back some of those Republicans, considering how much the party has become aligned with more hardline policies and figures like former President Trump or current governor Ron DeSantis, for that matter? And that's, of course, the same strain of things that led to you leaving the party in 2012.
Yeah, you know what? I think that's a great question, Danny, and it wouldn't surprise me to have some crossover, and I'll tell you why. In my last re-election to Congress, just last November, we received about 20% of the Republican vote, and I think even since then, there are probably more Republicans, moderate Republicans, obviously, that would be, pretty, I think, disappointed in the trajectory of the Republican Party today. The leadership that it had under former President Trump, and, you know, sort of the radicalization of the party, if you will, some denying that the insurrection was more than, you know, just kind of a tourist showing up to see the Capitol. I mean, some of the rhetoric we hear out of today's Republican politicians, at least, is pretty surprising.
And to that note, Governor DeSantis is pretty popular among Republicans. He has a pretty high approval rating. The last I saw, it was about 65%. When you were governor, within the first 2 years, you had a slightly higher approval rating, especially across the aisle. So I'm actually curious how you did that. How did you gain support from the political opposition or the other party? And do you think that kind of thing can actually be accomplished again in this very much more partisan world that we live in now?
I sure hope so, Danny. And I think that the way you do that is work across the aisle. And I did as governor. I think that it was important to do so because, you know, as I told some Republicans after I got elected governor as a Republican, and they wanted me to do some things that would affect voting in Florida, for example, things that I thought would be suppressing the vote. And I told them that I did not get elected the governor of the Republicans of Florida. I got elected the governor of the people of Florida, and always tried to comport myself that way because I felt a responsibility to do so. And I just thought it was the right thing to do. And it's the same thing I would do should I have the good fortune to win this election next year. And I do think people are starving for that kind of thing. I think that, you know, the degree of bickering and disagreement between the two parties, I think is pretty maddening for most Americans and most Floridians. And so I think it would be refreshing to have a governor that doesn't, you know, lean so far to the right as Governor DeSantis is certainly doing now, and have somebody who's more moderate, really more reflective of what I think modern Floridians are all about, trying to work together, do the right thing, and have a better future for their children.
And I just want to actually issue a slight correction to what I said previously. Governor DeSantis had about 65% approval before the pandemic, but now it's gone down. It's just over 50%. I just wanted to make that clarification.
Thank you. I wondered about that myself, yeah. So I appreciate that.
No problem. Congressman, a major issue you're going to face in the campaign is the question of when Governor DeSantis decided to reopen the state. Tens of thousands of people died in Florida. But on the other hand, Florida's death per capita rate is pretty similar to other states that remained locked down. You know, we have the states of California, New York, that just yesterday actually announced that they were finally reopening.
Right.
How are you going to address that? Because a lot of Floridians might look at it and say, hey, this is a good thing. You know, Florida's great. We've been reopened.
Well, you said it yourself at the outset of the question, and I think it was appropriate, Danny. You know, now it's over 37,000 of our fellow Floridians that have died from COVID. And I have to wonder in my mind if the governor had had a plan, if the governor had, you know, advocated mask wearing, if the governor had advocated social distancing, the kind of practical things that you know, you would have to do in order to save lives. How many more of those lives would still be with us? Those people would still be with us. And you know, I think it's a fair question. And I think a lot of the credit, if there is credit to go around in terms of, you know, how Florida has fared, really goes to mayors and county commissioners, local officials who had to come up with a plan themselves for their localities because of the lack of leadership from our governor. So I think the way, you know, the handling of the pandemic was done was subpar at best. And particularly, you know, what is disturbing to me is how the vaccines were distributed in Florida, where our governor, unfortunately, chose to go to Republican wealthy enclaves of donors to give out the vaccines and early on, which I think is wholly inappropriate, whether it was Ocean Reef in South Florida, Lakewood Ranch in the Tampa Bay area where I'm from, or other places. And that kind of fundamental unfairness of how you treat people in the time of a crisis where it's life or death is just appalling and you know, hard to even imagine.
Following on that, I have a two-part question to ask you. The first is, did Governor DeSantis do anything correct, in your opinion, in his response to the pandemic? And the second part is, how would you have handled reopening different, either on the timeline or other things?
I don't know what he did that was correct. You know, as I said, he gave it out to, you know, favored people at the outset of the vaccine being available. That's pretty appalling. He didn't have a plan. There still wasn't one, still isn't one, as to how to deal with it. So that was left to local officials. And to add insult to injury, Danny, he recently has signed a law trying to strip local officials of their authority to deal with things like a pandemic. So I can't give any kudos on how he handled the pandemic. The way I would have done it, number one, I would have distributed the vaccines fairly so that people in inner cities, brown and black people of the state of Florida, would have had equal access to the vaccine. That just wasn't the case. And when you pick Publix, which is a fine grocery store, to be one of the main distributors, you know, if you get into inner cities in most places in Florida, there's not a Publix there. So, you know, the obviousness of avoiding some in the state, I think was wrong. I would never do that. You know, you have to be fair. You have to be clear eyed and you have to face fundamental facts and science in order to deal with a pandemic like COVID-19.
Right.
And the governor didn't do that. And I certainly would. I would listen to science. I wouldn't listen to some of the quacks he listened to regarding herd immunity and things of that nature.
I'm speaking with Charlie Crist, Democratic congressman representing St. Petersburg and candidate for Florida governor. Crist is facing Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried in the Democratic primary. You can hear our interview with Commissioner Fried last week by going to our social media. If you have a question for the congressman, email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter. So, Congressman, this past legislative session, we saw Tallahassee take a lot of control away from local municipalities, which is something that's we're seeing happening more and more with every session. We actually created a podcast called Tallahassee Takeover that's examining this phenomenon. What's your opinion on under what circumstances the state should step in and supersede local governments, and in what times local governments should just be left to do what they want to do?
Well, they ought to be left to do what they want to do most of the time. you know, people elect their local mayor, their local city council, their local county commissioners for a reason. And I think the reason is that they want to have people that, you know, they know and they're close to be able to make decisions about their own neighborhood because they know it well. You know, it used to be the philosophy of the Republican Party that government closest to the people governs best. And you know, to see a reverse trend that we're seeing now out of Tallahassee is really strange because the Republicans have a majority in the House, a majority in the Senate, and obviously the governor's office presently. And so it's you know, odd to me that they're moving in a direction that wants to have, you know, Mount Tallahassee make all decisions about everybody in Florida instead of leaving, you know, decisions to localities, to the locally elected official.
Congressman, during your tenure as Florida governor, you were a self-described pro-gun person. You signed a bill allowing employees to bring guns to work as long as they were kept in the car. And now you've slightly changed your tune. You said in a campaign stop last week you'd move to ban assault weapons, call for stricter background checks. You didn't say it, but a lot of people would say, well, that's not pro-gun. Can you just help us understand where your change in positions came from on this particular issue?
Sure, and it really hasn't changed. I mean, you know, I'm pro Second Amendment. I understand what's in the Constitution and people have a right to bear arms. But I also understand when that was written, you know, you had to muzzle load a gun and we had no automatic weapons. And so it strikes me that, you know, banning automatic assault weapons is appropriate and just, and it's just common sense, Danny, to my way of thinking, because, you know, having assault weapons, automatic assault weapons, is really something appropriate for the military. It's really designed for one thing, killing people.
I will add automatic weapons are illegal. They've been illegal federally for a long time.
Yeah, well, they were. They aren't right now. And the guy who brought it about back in 1994 was a guy named Joe Biden when he was in the Senate. That ban lasted about 10 years. And unfortunately, it's not the case right now. And what we saw just last Saturday, I was at the SAD ceremony, the fifth anniversary of the Pulse, you know, nightclub massacre. Tragic. Where, you know, assault weapons, you know, automatic weapons were utilized. And, you know, it's just the kind of thing that I think we can do without and we should do without.
And we heard from one of our listeners on Twitter, Keila Selai Shepherd, and they want to know about your support for capital punishment and the lack of air conditioning in the Florida prison system. What kind of reforms do you think might have to happen in the Florida prison system right now?
Well, I think they should be air conditioned. I mean, you know, my gosh, we have to treat people humanely. That's why I fought so hard for automatic restoration of rights of former nonviolent felons when I was governor. In fact, I was asked about that a week before the election that year, whether I would support such a notion if I got elected, and I said that I would. And so the next spring, we got that adopted through the Florida cabinet. And during my 4 years as governor, 155,000 of our fellow Floridians had their rights restored who were former felons. And in the years since, it's dwindled down to the single thousands. And to me, that's appalling. And I can remember, Danny, at the time being asked by my then fellow Republicans, why would I do such a thing? And I said, well, that's how I was brought up. I believe in a word that I think is very important to Judeo-Christian teaching. I believe in forgiveness. And I still do. And I think it's important for all of us to embrace that and do unto others as we would have done unto ourselves. Follow the golden rule.
And Congressman, Governor DeSantis recently dedicated billions of dollars to Everglades restoration. You, in your time as governor, you did some work on Everglades restoration as well. Issues with green blue algae and red tide have increasingly become issues in Florida over the last couple years. If you become governor again, what will your plan for the Everglades be and for just the quality of our waters in the state of Florida?
That's a great question and a very important one. Yeah, when I was governor, we faced the Great Recession, the downturn in the economy, a tragic downturn in the economy. We had put into place the idea and the notion of purchasing, over 100,000 acres of sugar land and sugar farms to be able to turn that into a free flow of water, fresh water, to the Everglades, to Lake Okeechobee, and to the south. The natural flow, if you will, to restore that, which many scientists call for as a solution. As a result of the economic downturn, we had to reduce our purchase to about 27,000 acres. Still a fair amount, but not enough to complete the job. So something I would like to do if elected governor would be to be able to complete that job. And having a better economy under Joe Biden, I think we would have that opportunity. And I think it'd be great for Florida, great for the Everglades, and great for our environment.
The Congress has now passed a bill to make Juneteenth a federal holiday, and it's expected to be signed pretty soon by President Biden. This comes as the state's Board of Education has banned the teaching of critical race theory. You used to be education commissioner in the state of Florida, and I'm curious what thoughts you might have on this topic, on critical race theory, on the teaching of slavery and, you know, rough race relations in this country.
Well, you know, I think you have to be honest about what our history is and you know, be cognizant and aware that those who forget history may be destined to repeat it. And that's why people always talk about in terms of what happened in Nazi Germany with the Holocaust, that it's important to never forget what happened with that. It's important to never forget, you know, what has happened in our own history as it relates to race. And why we would want to have a head in the sand approach in our education is really beyond me. I don't really understand that. It's shocking. I'm very pleased that the bill for Juneteenth did pass, and it now will be a federal holiday. And as we sit here now, it's about 20 after one. In about 2 hours, you're right, President Biden is going to sign that into law. That's something we should all celebrate. And it's a great thing that it's happening today.
I've been speaking with Democratic Congressman Charlie Crist, running to become Florida's next governor. Congressman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Danny, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Likewise. And again, you can hear our interview with Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, Crist's primary challenger, by heading to WLRN.org/sundial. Still to come, why is Florida sending law enforcement to the U.S.-Mexico border? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Governor Ron DeSantis announced yesterday that Florida will be sending law enforcement to Texas and Arizona. The governors of the two states asked for assistance in battling illegal immigration at the border in a letter sent last week. Sheriffs from six Florida counties were with DeSantis at a press conference, pledging to support the effort. There are few details at this point as to how many law enforcement officials will be sent and how much the move will cost taxpayers. Joining us now is Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett. We'll also discuss the recent Peruvian elections. Tim, thanks for coming on.
Hey, Danny, how are you?
Great. So, Tim, how common is it for a governor to send law enforcement to another state to deal with immigration issues, given its first and foremost the purview of the federal government?
Not common at all, at least in my experience. I cannot recall an instance of Texas or any of the other border states in the past calling on other states to provide additional law enforcement for border protection, particularly since, as you just mentioned, this is a federal purview. It is not it's not in the portfolio of local law enforcement, although local law enforcement admittedly does have to contend with some of the effects of border crossings, particularly in Texas. But no, this is quite unprecedented in my experience anyway.
And what is the situation on the U.S.-Mexico border right now relative to years past? Kind of taking the last year as an exception because of the coronavirus. I know traffic went way down then.
Well, there is a border crisis in terms of the large increase and surge in undocumented migrants making crossings right now. Last month, we had about 180,000 apprehensions of undocumented immigrants crossing the border, according to Customs and Border Patrol. That's a two-decade high, and it's up 76% since February. So you do have a surge, and that surge is largely due to, I think, this impression amongst migrants from places like Central America, particularly Central America's northern triangle of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, that the change from a very anti-immigrant president, meaning President Trump, to a more immigrant-friendly president, being President Biden, would make things on the border more compatible for them. And so there's been this feeling that, well, it'll be easier to get into the United States now. So that's why we've seen this surge practically since the day President Biden took office back in January.
Right. And like you said, it's more immigrant friendly, but that might be lip service domestically, because on the other hand, we had Vice President Kamala Harris recently on a diplomatic mission in Central America to speak about the root causes of it. And she told Central Americans, do not come. You will not be allowed to come in. Do we have a sense of whether there are long-term solutions to this? Especially coming from Central America?
The only solutions really that we have available to us at this point, because we've put off immigration reform for so long in this country, the only solutions we do have available to us are long-term. And that means, as you just said, stopping illegal immigration at its source instead of at the border. And that's the whole point of the Biden administration plan that Vice President Harris is heading up now, to find ways to improve conditions in places like that northern triangle of Central America so that people will feel that they have a future in their own countries and that they don't have to escape by the thousands every day from those countries because of gang violence, because of very intense poverty, for example. And her message, really, I think critics of the Biden administration would say that her message from earlier this month to Central Americans, do not come, should have been uttered, again, as I mentioned, the day President Biden took office. I think it was a real flaw on the part of him and his administration not to realize that, as I said before, this image of a more immigrant-friendly president would bring a greater surge of immigrants. And they should have been making that message more strongly from the outset of his administration instead of 6 months after.
I'm speaking with WLRN's Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett. Yesterday, Governor Ron DeSantis announced the state will be sending law enforcement to assist with immigration issues at the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas and Arizona. You can read more about that story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Tim, let's move from the U.S.-Mexico border a little bit further south. The nation of Peru, it looks like it might have a new president-elect, and a controversial one at that. Right. Can you help us understand, who is Pedro Castillo?
Pedro Castillo is a teachers union leader in Peru. He's from the poor mountainous Andes regions of Peru. He represents a very rural, more indigenous constituency there that has always been sort of marginalized in Peru, particularly by the elites in the capital of Lima. But he has a very complicated platform, let's say. It's very murky, a very strange brew of, on the one hand, sort of Marxist-Leninist when it comes to economic policy, but as I've said in some of my articles, sort of Trumpist, really, when it comes to social issues, very conservative on things such as gay rights and abortion and things of that nature. So it's a little hard to peg him. The fear is that being a Marxist, a socialist, that he might try to bring the same sort of left-wing authoritarianism to the Peruvian government that we've seen, unfortunately, in places like Venezuela and Nicaragua in recent years.
And the election was an incredibly close presidential election. On the first count, the first full count, Castillo won by only slightly more than 44,000 votes.
Right.
How was he able to gain support over objections of these widespread fear of socialism in Latin America, especially like what you mentioned in Venezuela?
That's the very good question, because just a few years ago, we all thought of Peru as being sort of an economic and socioeconomic showcase for South America. It had experienced this economic boom. A lot of the fruits of that boom were going to improve the poverty rate, for example, in Peru, brought a lot more people into the middle class. And so there's this a lot of people are mystified that those good economic conditions would still result in a left-wing, sort of radical left-wing leader winning the presidential election there. What's often missed is that during that boom, corruption became just appalling in Peru. We've had five presidents in Peru in the past 5 years. Three of them have had to be removed because of massive public financial scandals. And so that has created a lot of anger amongst the working class in Peru. So have the situation during the pandemic. Peru has South America's lowest level of public health expenditure in South America. And that just made the country extremely vulnerable to the pandemic, which is why it now has the world's highest per capita COVID death toll. And that also has made a lot of people angry. So that anger, particularly amongst the poorer people and particularly amongst those more rural poor people that Castillo represents, that helped push him over the top.
Right. And to that point, we talk about Venezuela because it's such a disaster. It's universally basically acknowledged as a disaster. But is exactly. Bolivia more of a model for what Castillo is trying to do in Peru? He had strong indigenous support, rural support, and they've had booms. Is Bolivia more of a model that they're looking to pursue?
I think that's a good point, Danny. I think Bolivia probably is more a better analogy in terms of the Castillo phenomenon, the same sort of indigenous surge that brought Evo Morales to power a couple decades ago in Bolivia is very analogous to what brought Castillo to victory, a very narrow victory, albeit in Peru this month. And I think the fear is that, however, we may have seen, again, in Bolivia, we may have seen good economic results from time to time, but we also saw, again, like in Venezuela, the same sort of left-wing authoritarian populism in the person of Evo Morales that we saw in Venezuela in the person of Hugo Chavez and now in Nicolas Maduro. So Bolivia and Venezuela, I think, are both sort of showcases that have sparked that fear amongst a lot of Peruvians, particularly Peruvian expats here in South Florida, about what will happen when Castillo himself becomes president.
Right. And to that point, how have the expats in South Florida responded to the election results? You recently attended a protest.
Right, they're very angry about it, and they have joined the calls or the claims of Castillo's right wing opponent in the election, Keiko Fujimori. They have joined her claims that Castillo's campaign and his supporters in those Andean hinterlands in Peru committed massive voter fraud. That hasn't been proven yet, but the expats here are out in the streets claiming that Castillo committed voter fraud to win because they, like so many other expats here in South Florida, be it Venezuelan, Nicaraguan, Cuban, et cetera, they are very afraid very afraid of seeing their native country, come under the hold of left wing authoritarianism, which as they see it happening.
WLRN's Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Danny.
Still to come, a school yearbook, Black Lives Matter, and free speech. A controversy is stirring in a Broward County high school. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. A class of senior students prepped for graduation, picking up their caps and gowns, but no yearbook. West Broward High School administrators brought the yearbook's distribution to a halt because it included a Black Lives Matter spread they said was, quote, too politically one-sided. Eventually, the yearbooks were distributed again, this time with a letter from the school principal saying the political views in the book are not sponsored by the school district. We're joined now by the co-editor of the yearbook, Elise Twitchell. Elise, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. And also, we're joined by the school's yearbook teacher, David Fleischer. David, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So David, we'll start with you. How did you get the news that the distribution of the yearbook was going to be stopped? And what was it like breaking that news to your students?
So we found out that the yearbooks, that the sales and the distribution were going to stop on Friday afternoon via a text message I got from my AP. And there was no further message in there except just, please stop the distribution. We're going to stop it immediately. And then I didn't find out the exact details until later on in the day. And it was very shocking. It was crazy, to say the least. At first, I was afraid that we had let something slip in the senior section. Perhaps a quote got in there that should not have. But then when we found out, it was because of a BLM page. That was really, really hard to break to my students, because we had worked really, really hard on that book. We had worked really hard on that page, and we were really proud of it. And to hear that it was about the content of that spread was really hard.
And Elise, for you and your fellow students and your peers, what was it like to be on the receiving end of that news with the assistant principal telling David, this Black Lives Matter spread, we have an issue with it?
It was so shocking to me, because I didn't think that administration could do that to us. I thought they at least appreciated us a little bit, that they wouldn't do that to us. And it was just like, I was just so shocked that they would do that. And it was very disheartening, because like, we worked so hard and they didn't even give us a chance to like defend our own book.
And David, for those of us who haven't seen the yearbook, what did this spread include? Like, what did it look like, actually?
So I would like to think that it's one of our best pages. It's a beautiful page. It includes a history of the Black Lives Matter movement. It includes the names of individuals who have been killed, either from police brutality or through some other form of injustice. And basically, it just talks about the movement, and it talks about why it's important that we talk about Black lives now.
And Elise, what was it like for you putting those pages together and collecting all the content, all the names? And why was it important for you to be sure to include that in this year's yearbook?
Getting the content itself is pretty easy, because it's very widespread. Like, we just find all that stuff on the internet, and finding the pictures of our students that were in it were also easy, because we have a large Black population, and a lot of them went to those protests, and we were very grateful that we could get those pictures of students at protests. And I'm sorry, what was the last question?
Why was it important for you to include it in the yearbook?
It was important to me, especially because it's something that's happening to our student body. Our student body is affected by it, and I didn't want the conversation about it to stop. That's a main reason we put things in the yearbook, is so people can remember what happened. And I want those who have our yearbook to remember that Black Lives Matter was something that happened, and it's still important.
And David, it strikes me that Black Lives Matter is not necessarily in and of itself something partisan or overly political. I'm old enough to remember in 2014, the idea got support even from some conservatives like Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. And it's more of a cry for human rights that's been made into a political wedge issue. And I wonder if the school told you that a spread calling for the end of anti-Semitism, if they decided that that was too politically one-sided, do you think there would have been a different response to it, or would you have had a different response to it?
It's really hard to guess exactly what they would approve or not approve in the book, because our book has other spreads that you would say are probably far too political. We've got a spread on the election. We've got a spread on COVID, which obviously has become very political in a lot of ways. We have a spread on Pride, but our district actually has come out in support of Pride. They send emails all the time saying that we need to do the best we can to support our students. They have sent out an email stating that we need to discuss the events of January 6th. So they've brought a lot of conflicting things. So to be honest, I have no idea where we are now, but I'm very, very concerned about the future, because I expect that next year it's going to be hard to include stuff like this. And we want to talk about a lot of other issues going on, and that's going to be hard.
Right. And just to add to that, the district's perspective on this is that they don't support any politics displayed in the yearbook, and your guys' position is that there are no politics displayed in the yearbook.
Yes, that's exactly the point. And when they said that this was political, they're obviously specifically pointing to BLM, which is the problem here, and the much bigger issue that this, as you pointed earlier, it's about rights, it's about humanity, and they're calling it political. And yeah, this just we just don't know where to go from here.
I'm speaking with Elise Twitchell. She's the co-editor of the Edge yearbook at West Broward High School and the school's yearbook teacher, David Fleischer. We're talking about a Black Lives Matter spread that was included in this year's yearbook. Administrators brought the book's distribution to a halt because of the spread, calling it, quote, too politically one-sided. The book was redistributed with a letter from the principal saying that the district maintains a neutral stance on these political views. You can read more about this story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. David, West Broward High School wasn't the only school to include a Black Lives Matter spread in the yearbook. Have you heard from other schools that have possibly received a similar response to this kind of thing?
So there's a lot of schools that have included spreads like this. In fact, when I talked to some other advisors and when I saw some other books, ours is probably one of the most tame. A lot of the other ones called for people to stand up, and obviously they really tried to make a big issue of it, which they should to a large degree, because this is a big moment. But I haven't heard about anyone else getting the pushback like this. But to the attorney for the district, she did make it very clear, unfortunately, that if they do get complaints about the BLM spread at any other school, they'll treat it the same. But I've also heard on top of that from some attorneys and whatnot throughout the country that there are issues arising with BLM spreads all over. So this is not unique to South Florida.
And did you reach out to or speak with former Superintendent Robert Runcie about this issue?
So I've tried to speak with numerous people in the district. I can't get a hold of anyone. The only way I got a hold of the attorney was by telling them I was going to be going on national news. But I haven't gotten a response back from the cadre director. I haven't gotten it back from OSPA. I went in front of the school board on Tuesday. And I was right in front of Mr. Runcie. That was in front of the entire board. I asked for them to have a meeting with us, and I haven't heard a thing from them since. So,
Elise, the yearbook was eventually redistributed, but with that letter from the school principal saying that the political views in the book are not sponsored by the school district. What are your thoughts on that letter? Or what are your friends that you worked on it with? How do you guys feel about that letter?
To me, and especially to my co-editor in chief, Kennedy, it was kind of like a slap in the face, because it was the district saying that we don't support you. That's how I felt. That it would said is that we don't support you. We don't support, you know, how much work you put into this book, and BLM isn't something that's political. We never wanted it to be like political. We tried to remain as unbiased throughout our whole entire book. And so to me, it's crazy that they would categorize it as something that is one-sided when it's really not.
And what's been the response from students, especially Black students at your school, about this?
A lot of those that I've talked to find it outrageous that it's been happening, and they support the yearbook team and all of this so much. And a lot of them are seniors, and they want to help us, and they just feel out like outrageous about this whole situation.
And David, to that point, Black students are a minority at West Broward. Do you have any worries about the message the district is sending to those students and their families by doing this?
Yes, I'm deeply concerned. And it's not just at our school. There's 210,000 students of color in our district. And I'm just concerned that when they say, hey, we can talk about any subject except for race, that sends a really important message to those students that their struggles, their stories, that they don't matter. And I think that's a really big problem.
Elise, you graduated just this year, so you're moving on from being in the school's yearbook staff. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
And I'm curious, what are the conversations happening between you and the incoming editors who are going to be picking this up next year and working through it?
I give them my full support with anything that they do. And I think it'll be definitely a little bit harder for them to cover stuff like this when administration and the district is kind of crawling up their back. But, you know, we all support how far this has gone, and they kind of want to focus on West Broward. And, you know, I don't blame them, because they need to focus on their own book and how their book can make a difference, just like mine did.
And David, what's next with this? Are there ongoing communications with the district? Like, where do things move from here?
to be honest, I'm not exactly sure where it moves. And I know that that's not a great answer. I would love for us to continue the conversation with the district, but right now they won't even have that conversation with us. We're trying to set up a meeting. We would love to talk to them about ways that we can support our Black students in the community and our students of color. And they won't even have that conversation. So I guess the first step is, will they actually sit down at the table with us?
I'd like to thank our guest, Elise Twitchell. She's the co-editor of the Edge yearbook at West Broward High School, and the school's yearbook teacher, David Fleischer. Elise and David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This Saturday is Juneteenth. It commemorates the day emancipation reached enslaved people from the deepest parts of the South, when a Union general went into Galveston, Texas, and announced they were now free. That was on June 19, 1865, over 2 years after the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. The Senate unanimously passed a resolution to mark Juneteenth as a federal holiday. It's expected to be signed by President Joe Biden today. Last year, we spoke with Femi Folami Brown ahead of the commemoration. She's a researcher and produced the film When Liberty Burns about the McDuffie Rebellion in 1980 in Miami. Luis Hernandez spoke with Brown about what Juneteenth means to her and how she talks about it with her grandson. Here's an excerpt from that conversation, which began with her discussing the fears she has for her grandson as a young Black man.
It is a hard conversation to have. I remember just a year ago, I was babysitting or child sitting with him while his mother was on a business trip. And I posted on Facebook that I dropped him off at the bus stop in Plantation, Florida. And I realized he was the only child at the bus stop in that neighborhood, which is a upper middle class neighborhood. And I could not pull away. There was an innate fear of leaving him unprotected. So with that said, you can imagine how I must be feeling now, having to encounter the same fear only intensified. I realized that while we tried to shield him from, you know, what is a harsh reality, we can no longer do that. So we are having that conversation, and we are letting him know that he is loved, he is valued, he matters, and that we will do all we can to protect him. And we will do that with love, you know, and we will have the conversations, the tough conversations, not necessarily with him, but with others who are not people of color, so that perhaps we can influence, you know, the way the world looks at black boys and black men.
Do you talk to him about Juneteenth? And I wondered, for you, like, growing up, what did that mean? What did Juneteenth mean? What does it mean
absolutely
for you now?
Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. It was a regional holiday in Texas that just became a state holiday in 1980, 79 or 80. And here in Miami, I did not learn about Juneteenth until perhaps a decade ago. Much like the slaves didn't find out they were free until 2.5 years later. This again points to how our history was muddled, and the narrative was, we were not given privy to the actual history of black people, not until archives and digital information became available and we started doing our own research, and now we can correct the narrative. I personally would not celebrate Juneteenth as a happy holiday, because it just underscores the idea that, you know, black people were kept enslaved for an additional 2.5 years. But I do understand that, you know, we want to have a holiday like Kwanzaa, like Juneteenth, that we can celebrate our people and our culture. So while I'm rather old school and as a researcher, you know, I have a particular perspective, I do understand that it is catching on and that other states have declared it a holiday. And I'm not sure of the status of Florida, but as a kid, and I checked with a neighbor who is younger, but had lived in Texas and grew up in Miami, and she told me that outside of, you know, Texas, you know, she had not celebrated it either.
Right.
So. That was WLRN's Luis Hernandez speaking with Femi Folami Brown. You can hear our full conversation with Brown from last year and find more of our coverage of Juneteenth events this weekend by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Again, President Biden is expected to sign Juneteenth into law as a national holiday later today. And that's Sundial for Thursday, June 17th. Coming up next week on Sundial, California and Florida took radically different approaches to the coronavirus pandemic. Now that both states are fully reopened, what lessons were learned from the past 15 months? Which state was more successful in protecting lives and the economy? A collaboration between KQED in San Francisco and WLRN. Plus, the country's first Caribbean Heritage Museum opens to the public in a large gala event next weekend. We'll speak with the director of the museum about the history of the Caribbean diaspora in South Florida and some of the artifacts you'll be able to find within the institution. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with more live shows next week. The program is made possible in part by support from the Miami Cancer Institute.